What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hey, welcome to IKEA, where even this desk is circular.
Huh, how so? Looks pretty rectangular to me.
It's because we're always looking to repair, reuse, and relove our products, like buying back your IKEA items for store credit. Or shop our as-is section for great deals. You can even order free spare parts. Get on the circular path for a more sustainable future.
Still a rectangle.
Get started at ikea-usa.com/circular. Visit ikea-usa.com/circular for as-is information and buyback and resale terms and conditions. Spare parts not available for all products.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Food, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Tippin, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Rafia Zafar about her 2019 book, Recipes for Respect, African-American Meals and Meaning, from the University of Georgia Press. It's part of the Southern Foodways Alliance Studies in Culture, People, and Place series. Rafia Zafar is professor of English, African and African American Studies, and American Culture Studies at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. Rafia writes about the intersection of food, authorship, and American identities, 19th century Black writers, and the Harlem Renaissance. She's the faculty director of the Mellon Mays Undergraduate Fellowship Program. Rafia, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Carrie. I'm delighted to be on.
Thanks. I'm really excited to be talking to you today. I thoroughly enjoyed reading your book, so I have a lot that we want to discuss. We have common interests in cookbooks, not just as archives for historical information about how people eat, but also as literary and artistic and culture-making documents. So in this book, you're interested in food as a field of action, which I'm going to get you to talk about in a moment, but your primary object of analysis are cookbooks. So what is it that drew you to the study of cookbooks after beginning your research in more traditional literary genres? So maybe tell us a little bit about the arc of your research agenda.
Right. Well, you know, and I started grad school. I was already a grown-up. I had worked in book publishing for 6 years. I worked in book publishing. I was, you know, your typical undergraduate, and I grew up in a home where my mother was not a good cook at all. So I can't say, oh, I learned about cooking at my mother's knee. My mother had lots of cookbooks. I don't even know I think my mother had two cookbooks, one of which was her mother's. I think it was called The American Woman's Cookbook. I still have it at home, and maybe Betty Crocker. She didn't have anything as fancy as The Joy of Cooking. My father's mother, whose own family members allegedly included two older sisters who ran or even owned a cafe in Atlantic City called the Timo Sisters Cafe or something to that effect. But I didn't grow up with cooks. I didn't grow up with people who collected cookbooks. I got interested in cookbooks after... I worked in publishing, and I thought I was going to go to grad school, and I was very interested in the Harlem Renaissance. But en route to that, I was working in a store, which is a well-known store now, called Dean and DeLuca, but then it was called the Cheese Store. And I just started learning about different kinds of foods, that food was more varied, learning more about different sort of cultural groups, command of or claim to certain kinds of foods. And by the time I got to grad school, I was putting together those two things in my mind, what I had learned as a working person about quote unquote gourmet food and specialty food and my interests in Black cultural life.
So what do you think is the relationship between cookbooks and like novels or other objects of scholarly study in literature?
Well, so many people have said they read cookbooks like novel. I don't even think you could get quotes from all of them. But I know Janice Langone, who's a now the emeritus curator of the Clements Library, and their fabulous cookbook collection at the University of Michigan has said this. It's probably a long list of those of us who've written about cookbooks who say we read cookbooks like novels, because though we can think today of a standard cookbook, which has the orientation clause. I mean, I know about sort of the linguistic stuff of recipes from Colleen Cotter's work on it. There's an orientation clause that tells you what's going to go on or what's happened or what the outcome will be. There'll be a list of ingredients, and then there'll be a paragraph with instructions, you know, break 12 eggs, you know, put them in this, put them in that, you know, stir them, bake them, fry them, whatever. What you learn when you read cookbooks, when you start reading a lot of cookbooks, more recently, it's because now it's a kind of memoir, that cookbooks contain more than instructions for replicating a particular dish or a meal. And in my research as a grad student in 19th century African American texts, I found in my readings a couple of what I would call hospitality books that had recipes authored by Black men in the early part of the 19th century by Robert Roberts and Tunis Campbell, and then later in the 19th century works by Melinda Russell and Abby Fisher in the mid to late 19th century, and seeing that not all, but a lot of them have instructions. They have actually recipes, if not recipes for meals, but recipes for life, recipes for how one interacts with whites and or employers, recipes for how one becomes socially apt, recipes for how one can become an entrepreneur. So I got very interested in these other kinds of recipes, the narrational parts of cookbooks. I mean, today, I mean, one of the arguments, little arguments I make is that in some ways, 19th century or early 20th century works, like someone like Rufus Estes, or even Melinda Russell, who appended slave narratives or slave narratives of a relative to their cookbooks, are actually demonstrating that the cookbook with memoir goes back way beyond someone like Ruth Reichel or Alice B. Toklas or M.F.K. Fisher, that this is a kind of a subgenre of what we would think of the straight up cookbook. And in fact, the Library of Congress changed its classification of cookbooks. I'm trying to remember 10 or 15 years ago, but they're now also considered a literary genre.
Yeah, that all seems right to me. Let's talk a little bit about the idea of food as a field of action. That's the subtitle of your introduction and a key premise of the book. So maybe define for our listeners what you mean by that term, and how does it form the basis of the argument in the book?
Yeah, the food, I mean, I recommend highly reading the anthropologist Mary Douglas. If you want to learn a lot about food and why people think about food or respond to food from a vantage point of an anthropologist who's thinking about what do we do with food, that is, as a food field of action. And among other things, she's written about food as taboo, right? What you can eat, what you can't eat, what's good to eat, why eschewing or wanting certain kinds of food tells people what group you belong to, and also how withholding food from people is a way of, you know, inscribing a boundary. And we see this very, very clearly, this the idea of food as a field of action we see it in lunch counters. The lunch counters, I write about Ann Moody's coming of age in Mississippi, and Ann Moody's is the iconic face we see in so many U.S. history books, as she's sitting there on the, at the counter of a Woolworths after having with her friends politely requesting that they be served and having all sorts of food and insults and worse dumped on her, being physically attacked for something as simple as just asking for, you know, a grilled cheese sandwich and a Coke. So it's, food is a field of action then, or we can say Woolworths diner food is a field of action in that some people want to keep it from other people. So the food itself becomes a marker in this case of citizenship. And a number of people have written about it. Mark Wiener has written a nice article about it, how essentially the denial of Coca-Cola, right, which is a real American symbol, right? We've seen the Coca-Cola bottle, the Coca-Cola bottle lettering in different alphabets, you know, whether it's English or whether it's in Arabic. It's a sign of the United States. So by denying African Americans the right to have a Coca-Cola and a grilled cheese sandwich is white supremacists saying, you do not deserve to be Americans. We're not going to let you become Americans or function as Americans. And one easy way to do that is to deny you something that supposedly anyone in the United States can have.
Yeah, so as the food itself is kind of a field of action, then the cookbook too seems to be a place where subversive messages can be kind of put across. So what are some of the subversive messages that you talk about in the book? How are these cookbooks enacting resistance or offering recipes for respect? That's the title of the book. So what does that phrase mean to you?
Well, a recipe for respect, again, to think back on the sort of the narrative portions of some of the think particularly of cookbooks, but I see it in other ways. But when someone like Robert Roberts or Tunis Campbell addresses either, you know, we assume they're fictional, but maybe not. Maybe these are real young people. And it's an avuncular tone where he's where Roberts is telling these two young people, two young men in male names, that they need to do such and such to have a good job, to be respected, to feel respected. You know, what you can and can't do when you're working in service. And then by following his injunctions, right, and his suggestions, this allows African Americans to secure employment. Steady employment and respectable employment, right? You're not doing more than ditch digging, right? If you think about it, there were very limited economic options, career options for African Americans until actually, when you think about it, pretty darn recently. So a position where you were indoors, where you could be nicely dressed, not out there, you know, chopping cotton or digging ditches, this was a better job. But there was a job that one could hold while also guarding one's self-respect. And so these are sort of these, not quite between the lines, but they're almost prefaces to the recipes or the instructions for running a household that Roberts offers.
So the book contains 7 chapters, and they cover the earliest formally published African-American authored hospitality books of the 1820s to Edna Lewis's Taste of Country Cooking from the 1970s, and a lot of other things in between. Each chapter examines a set of related texts that are in conversation with one another and with the historical moment of their publication. So the first chapter I found surprising, I think, for uncovering those earliest recipe or manuals with recipes were published by men and before the Civil War. And that's kind of surprising, I think, to probably a lot of people. So maybe describe those hospitality books. You've mentioned them a little bit already, but what's in them? Who's the audience? And what kind of makes them special apart from cookbooks that we might expect?
Yeah, well, as I said, they're hospitality books. So Robert Roberts was, I don't know whether we would call him a free Black. He was a free Black. He may have been born in slavery in South Carolina. It's likely. Tunis Campbell was born free in New Jersey. Roberts' book came out in the 1820s, Campbell's in the 1840s. Campbell was the manager of a hotel in downtown Manhattan. Roberts was the butler for Governor Gore of Massachusetts. So they were both men who were in positions of great responsibility, as well as public figures, right? If you're running a hotel, you're going to be in the public. If you're running a governor's household, of course, as the butler, of course, you're going to be on in that sense, on stage a lot of the time. Now, Roberts and Campbell are interesting because they were at the same time, you would think that these are men who are, I don't know, some people might say toadies because they're working in service. They are also both abolitionists. They both have left a trail of abolitionist writings and activities. Campbell, after the Civil War ended, became one of the first elected officials in Georgia. So these are men, and I think this is true of women as well in the 19th century, people of African descent, is one of the strategies, and I guess one of the qualities that one needed was to be able to toggle back and forth between being sort of this consummate, person of all trades for in a white establishment, as well as someone who was proud of who they were and someone who was advocating for the rights of their fellow African Americans. And the two of them did both things quite well. What's interesting is that they both were men. Yeah. And I think part of that has to do with the differing rates of literacy, as a man would be more likely, and this is true with whites, than women to be literate, as well as just the difference between what that we, you know, they used to call this the sort of the spheres, the gender spheres in the 19th century, where men were seen as the people who would engage in the public sphere, and women's sphere was the private one. So that might be one of the reasons we see these earliest books written by men. But it's one of the reasons, but maybe not all of the reasons. Now that they wrote cookbooks or hospitality books, I see as a way of them leveraging their knowledge about how to run a household, along with gaining the status of an author, which would gain them both increased status, right? Social status, as well as funds. It's said, and I have to look for it, I can't find it right now, that Robert Roberts, in fact, his guide to running the, you know, the consummately well-run household was in the library of one of the Confederate Army generals. And this is, I found particularly interesting with both of them, that at the same time, mainstream United States believed in the inferiority, if not even the dirtiness, of African Americans, the sort of the uncivilizedness of African Americans. You have two, you know, well-regarded hospitality books that were written by Black people telling white people how to run an elegant household, how, in other words, how to be bourgeois, how to be upper class. And, you know, the paradox is it was Black folks who were telling white folks how to do this. And you can perhaps think that's because African Americans have long said that it was important for our community to know the other community very well, because quite literally, your life depended on you're knowing more about them than they knew about you.
The second chapter looks at the connections between slave narratives and postbellum recipe collections. You make a case that these two genres are closely linked, with the recipe collection earning authority based on the authority of that earlier genre. So what do you see as the literary links between these two genres?
Well, I think, well, the authority thing, it has a lot to do with, I think, the Uncle Tom's Cabin. I'll just get it right out there, right? This is a novel written in 1852 that became the first million copy seller after the Bible. At its two of the figures at the heart of the narrative are two Black women cooks, Aunt Chloe, who, I mean, I say aunt, that's how, you know, they were rendered in the text. Chloe, who was the wife of Uncle Tom, and Dinah. I think it's Dinah. No, it's not Dinah. Chloe and it's going right out of my head. But they're two chefs. One of whom is both of them are seen as these consummate, intellects, geniuses, unlettered geniuses of the kitchen, who are not described as being literate by any chance, but they are described as having this, and this is something that has come down to us to the present day, that there is something about being a Black woman that fits you for being a chef, that you don't have to do anything. It's a priori knowledge. Somehow, magically, you get a Black woman in the kitchen, give her some ingredients, and some incredible meal is going to appear. This you see in Uncle Tom's Cabin with these two chefs. In fact, Chloe even says at one point, jokingly, to her white putative owner, it's like, well, get out of, you know, she sort of shoos her out of the kitchen and says, well, just look at my hands. Look at your hands. They're so delicate and white. Look at my great big, you know, I think she uses a word, something like stumping or stumpy hands. You can tell my hands were made for making pie crust and yours, well, you know, they're made for sitting in the parlor, perhaps. That's not exactly what she says. But the whole notion is that Black people were fitted by nature for service, not for intellectual endeavors. And they didn't need to be taught these things. Somehow it was just going to happen. So with Uncle Tom's Cabin, and then it became, as I said, a million copy seller. You had many of the Southern apologists for slavery writing their own kind of contra novels, again, with this image of an African-American woman slave creating these amazing things in the kitchen. Essentially, this is the stereotype against which African-Americans have to deal with for the next, well, it's not quite 200 years yet, but it's for a very, very long time. So I'm interested, I got very interested in looking at these slave narratives, for example, the ones that preface cookbooks, because they're a way essentially of saying, I really know how to cook, because the reader, of the author of the text knows the reader, that your mainstream white American reader already associates African-Americans with being culinary geniuses. So by putting that at the front of the book, they're kind of underscoring it, saying, oh yeah, this person was a slave, or their family were slaves. They'll know how to cook.
Yeah, you ask a really important question in that chapter that I'm wrestling with myself, and I'm quoting here. You say, combining a cookbook with a slave narrative offers the implied audience a curious set of choices. Does one read to learn how to make ginger snaps, or does one read to learn of injustice overcome and a bright future ahead of darkness? Can one book do both? So talk a little bit more about the significance of that question, and if you have an answer for it, maybe.
Well, I don't know whether I have an answer for it. I mean, because this is all speculative, right? I wish I could go back and interview some of these writers, but I think it's not a mistake that African Americans saw entrepreneurship as a way up. I mean, Booker T. Washington is kind of infamous for promoting vocational education because he thought financial stability and success would lead to civil rights rather than the other way around. Right. And that you did not need a you know, a Harvard education like W.E.B. Du Bois to be successful in the world. And, you know, in truth, that kind of education, even in the South, even in an HBCU, was going to be very difficult for any African-American for any number of reasons, not just financial. So becoming a chef and then perhaps a caterer like Abby Fisher, or a Pullman chef and personal chef like Rufus Estes, who publishes Good Things to Eat by Rufus, is a way of using that stereotype, you know, Black people really know how to cook, with their business skills and publication to leverage access to maybe a different social sphere, but also additional income, right, and status. If you're a cook, you know, in a house, that's one thing. But if you're a cook in a house, but you're also publishing your recipes, then you're not just a cook. Then people might think of you as a chef as well as an author. So there are a couple things going on when people decide they're going to publish a book. Publishing books was not quite the same way. Also, people published books with printers. This was true with whites as well as Blacks. So that one of the strategies for Melinda Russell published her cookbook to help secure the livelihood of herself, but also her child, which was the same strategy that Harriet Wilson, who wrote an autobiographical novel or a fictional autobiography around the start of the Civil War, also mid 19th century. And she and Melinda Russell say the same thing, that they're writing these books, they're putting these books before the public in the hopes that this will gain them the financial stability that will allow them to raise their child.
Yeah, so in the next chapter, you focus on George Washington Carver, not just as a figure in food science, which is how I think most people think of him, but as a person who cooked for a living and as a writer of recipes. So where are those recipes being published? Who is the audience for those?
Yeah, well, Carver, you know, Carver is and actually his graduate degree is in mycology. He was a fungi specialist, right? We always associate him with peanuts, but he's more than peanuts. He started out at Iowa State as in grad school, and actually turned down an offer to join the faculty of Iowa State to go to Tuskegee because he felt that he needed to help his people. He thought that was more important. The recipes, which, you know, it's not clear, you know, cookbooks in the 19th century and the 20th century, if not even the 21st century, often share recipes. It doesn't mean that they asked for permission, but certain things circulated, like scripture cake is a recipe that will turn up in any number of cookbooks. But who invented scripture cake, right? The recipes aren't copyrighted. So some of the recipes that Carver included might be written by him. Some of them, he acknowledges in one of his notes that he thanks people for some of the recipes, some of the cookbooks that he's consulted for some of the recipes included. But some of them are undoubtedly his because of the language of the recipes. He published these recipes in something called an Agricultural Extension Bulletin. And there were dozens published by Tuskegee. Because Tuskegee was a rarity, it was not a white land-grant institution, a historically white institution, but it was a historically Black institution that was, through Booker T. Washington's sort of, I'd say, political genius, had an extension school assigned to it. So Carver believed in, like Booker T. Washington, in self-sufficiency and self-pride. And so they saw the bulletins as a way to help secure the livelihood of the African-American farmer. But he was not only interested in telling people how to hill sweet potatoes, but also how to make them, how to make dishes with them, and not just simple dishes, but also variety of meals. He also was a big believer in people always having what we call now a kitchen garden, so that He discouraged people, whether they were sharecroppers or small farmers, from planting edge to edge in cotton or tobacco, but always reserving some part of their holdings, even if they were rented, for collards, corn, maybe some chickens, so that people could be self-sufficient and not rely on the company store. This way, people would have a better diet, a more nutritionally well-rounded diet, but also not end up in debt to the company store, to the plantation stores, which always would overcharge. So that would keep people in their, you know, in their financial bond forever, what's called debt peonage for sharecroppers. But even if you all manage to own your land, and many Black folks through, I mean, unbelievable odds did. I mean, African Americans owned millions of acres of land when the story of how that had that fell apart in the 20th century has been written by other people. But there, of course, there was a recognition of it, and supposedly the government is going to make restitution for the denial of funds and support that they were given to white farmers. But it's too late for many farmers who've passed away or lost their land. But he wanted to make the life of the African-American farmer better. And this was one of the ways he did it.
Yeah, so it seems like those don't just include recipes for how to use ingredients, but recipes for respect. Will you say a little bit more about some of those instructions?
Yeah, well, one of the things he said that I thought that was really, I found it moving, is that he thought that flowers, you know, and this made me think of Alice Walker's essay In Search of Our Mother's Gardens. He thought that flowers could be as much of a tonic as medicine. And so he urged people to grow flowers as well. He urged people not just to say, make a slice of, like a sliced tomato salad or tomato soup. But at one point he says tomatoes as a crop come in such varieties, you can use them as decorations. So he thought not just about feeding people literally, but he thought about feeding people's souls. And that was something that comes through in some of his little instructions within the recipes or in headnotes or in the sort of the introductory materials.
The next chapter kind of looks away from cookbooks towards memoirs and novels of the civil rights era. So novels from Ann Moody, Alice Walker, Ernest Gaines. What's the place of those non-cookbooks alongside these other chapters with more traditional recipe texts?
Yeah, well, this is, you know, they are in some ways another way that, you know, one of the things I thought about with the book was I wanted to look at different ways that food was a field of action. Right. So it can literally be a field of action in the sense that people are using their knowledge of food to gain social status and, you know, social mobility and civil rights. Right. By becoming someone recognized as an author, people will think differently of you. Right. By becoming someone whose books sell, you'll have an additional income stream. So, you know, that's kind of couple of ways that cookbooks function as a field of action. Writing about food or thinking about food is another way of thinking of food as a field of action. And with Moody, we've already talked about the lunch counters, right? The denial, the rejection of people of shared foods with a dining, like something like a dining counter at Woolworth. But in, say, Ernest Gaines, it's elderly white woman. Decision to share this basket of neatly wrapped sandwiches to a gathering of people who are both white and Black in Louisiana in a period of, you know, we'll say so-called desegregation, right? Because there's a pair of football heroes, one white and one Black, who are, you know, part of this large cast of characters, but it's generally, it's quite obvious when you read the text that the racial status quo is still very much in effect. So when this woman, Miss Merle, brings around her baskets and she gives sandwiches to everyone. That's an example of food being a field of action, right? If Douglas talks about food being one, she talks about the denial of food being a ruthless, something to the effect of a ruthless twist of hospitality, then Merle's offering of sandwiches to people young and old, white and black, shows that there is perhaps not the desegregation that would come around in 40 years or 50 years, because the book is kind of told from a couple of different standpoints. So somebody's looking back and narrating this, but that there is that possibility, right? There is the promise of it. There is movement toward that. If even though they're not sitting around the dining room table, they're standing around in a yard somewhere, but they're all getting the same food and they're eating it at the same time.
Yeah, so even though these books don't contain recipes for food, they do describe acts of eating or refusal to eat as a means of protest. So even if they don't have these recipes for cooking, what are the recipes for respect in each of these texts?
Right. Well, the recipe for respect is what Miss Merle is doing. By showing a white character sharing food, that's a field of action. In Alice Walker's Meridian, another novel I write about, you see an interracial group of civil rights workers, again, during the height of the civil rights movement in Mississippi. One of the workers is an African-American man. He marries a white Jewish woman, and with another friend, an African-American man, they go to a Greasy Spoon and they celebrate being served there, even though the food is horrible. So it's like, yay, we got it. We went to the Moonflower and we got served. Except that there were white supremacists watching them. And so they're breaking two taboos. There's both the interracial taboo, the gender one, right? Miscegenation. So you have a black man with a white woman, and then you have black people eating with white people. So there's a double taboo that's being broken there. So you see that food becomes a field of action when people insist on being served and do get served, right? So in contradistinction to Ann Moody, they do get served. But by getting served, they lay themselves open to gunfire. And one person ends up severely wounded by the white supremacists who take note of this and lie in wait for them on another evening.
Wow. So the next chapter looks at how two cookbooks construct autobiographies and family histories through cookbook narratives. And that's Verda Mae Smart Grosvenor's Vibration Cooking and Carol and Norma Jean Darden's Spoonbread and Strawberry Wine. You argue that both books are in conversation with ideas about a monolithic Black cuisine and that they each have a very different agenda about how they're going to define African-American culture. So what are some of the key differences in those two books?
Well, they're class and educational differences. I think they're regional differences. They're both, interestingly though, the both of them grow up in the North. Verda Mae grows up in Philadelphia, and the Darden sisters grow up in suburban New Jersey. The Dardens, however, go to Sarah Lawrence, and I like to think of their father's a physician, and I like to think of them as a sort of the avatar of the new generations who grow up going to white schools and growing up in integrated suburbs. Verda Mae's family is working class and more noticeably Southern, or Geechee, as she says. The Travel Notes of a Geechee Girl is the subtitle of her book. And she was, rather than going off as the Dardens did to college, an elite, historically white college at 18, she instead has been following sort of the bebop movement and goes to Paris. She decides to go to Europe. She ends up falling in with a group of bohemians, marries a white sculptor, and is befriended by and is friends with some of the African-American movers and shakers of the era, like musicians like Sun Ra or actor Raymond St. James. I mean, like Alice B. Toklas, he's a name dropper. And they both will name Toklas and Grosvenor, Smart Grosvenor, name many of their recipes after the folks that they have come in contact with. So, you know, Toklas will refer to eggs, Francis Bacabia, and then Ferda May has the Raymond St. Jacques pancakes, which I recommend highly, by the way. I would make them in grad school. I think they are light and delicate. But she also was more overtly centered on herself, and not in a bad way, but as someone who is a contemporary activist, whether she's an arts activist or a civil rights activist. And the Dardens were going back in time, right? They were, can't remember whether it was at a party or is it college. And they were said, oh, people, your family is so interesting. They must have a lot of old recipes. And they end up going to the South and very carefully recording these conversations and exchanges they had with family and family friends, and then recording the recipes very precisely. And I've said before that it's almost as though they're providing operating instructions for the children and the products of these desegregated, integrated spaces for how to be properly Black, at least in terms of cuisine. So they, like one point of difference is the way they both cookbooks offer recipes for Hop and John, which is seen as a signature New Year's Day dish. And greens are supposed to accompany them, right? Greens, the dollars, you know, you're supposed to have money in the good year, in the new year. And black-eyed peas and rice are supposed to bring good luck. Now, when the Dardens give you the recipe, it's very precise. They tell you how much water to use and how many beans and how to cook the beans and what kind of spices and how to fluff the rice and the peas together. And Vermeer's recipe is basically four lines, like cook peas, cook rice, mix together, voila, in new season to taste. So she's assuming a certain expertise on the part of her readers, as opposed to the Dardens. But more importantly, she goes on to say, you know, Black people have been making this dish for so many years. I think it's a new day, right? This is the late 60s. She's writing this after the 60s, after the Black Power movement, after the, you know, the apogee of the civil rights movement, as we're moving into Black Power, and says, and so we're not going to do that anymore. You know, we're going to do some, I'm going to do something new on New Year's Day. And that kind of, that recipe, those two approaches to the recipe, I think sum up this sort of the, I think the ideological differences between the two cookbooks.
Yeah, agreed. That example was really powerful. Yeah. So in the next chapter, when you talk about Edna Lewis, you call it elegy or Sankofa. And I saw in that chapter, again, the mark of a literary scholar. So what does it mean to compare a recipe collection to that poetic form of the elegy? And what's the difference between elegy and Sankofa?
Well, let's just start by definitions, rough definition of elegy. Elegies were originally poems written generally by men, right? Because male poets were the ones getting published, who wrote to commemorate the death or the loss of a friend. Generally a male friend, okay? So this was a genre of poems. Sankofa is not a literary genre. What it is a sign that's been adopted, a symbol adopted by African Americans. It's from the Akan. It's a West African word, essentially meaning to go ahead, to move forward, you have to look back. And often the sort of the pictograph for the Sankofa bird is a bird, like, and most of the body is facing forward, but the bird's looking back, right? That you have to know your history in order to go forward. So that's kind of what I think of is going on with Edna Lewis, is that she is remembering Freetown, which was a community of former slaves in Virginia that she grew up in, that her grandparents were founders of. And she wants people to know that there's a certain kind of food. And I think part of this is I won't say it's a dig, but revealing that African-American foodways is not about, you know, what became branded as soul food in the 1960s, but it's something more complex and sophisticated and very what we think of seasonal, farm to fork, right? Local, hyper-local eating. That's Edna Lewis. The Sankofa is that she's asking people, the young people, I think she's hoping will read her cookbook to know, to go forward, right? To go forward in terms of gastronomy, you have to know that, say, African-American foodways are more than just grits and greens, right? It's a much more complex, sophisticated diet. At the same time, she also connects things up with the African heritage, as she does by mentioning guinea fowl, for example, right? Because those were, you know, people didn't necessarily just have chickens. They also had guinea fowls, you know, because there's the guinea fowl and things like benny seeds and okra are part of the African. We think of the Columbian Exchange, where things like tomatoes and potatoes went east. Well, the African Exchange would be where things like a watermelon and the sesame seeds, et cetera, would go west.
Yeah, and in the last two chapters with Grosvenor and the Darden sisters, and in this chapter with Edna Lewis, you draw a connection to Alice B. Toklas's cookbook. And I was interested in the ways that you were working, how they were talking back against the genre there. What's the sort of the difference between how Toklas remembers the dead or the past and how Edna Lewis does?
Well, yeah, that gets back to the elegy versus Sankofa. I mean, I have this chapter in Recipes is a sort of a smaller version of a longer meditation I wrote about the two. And I look at Toklas. Toklas's recipes, again, like Smart Grosvenor, when she, of course, preceded either of them, since the Alice B. Toklas book comes out in the 1950s, she is remembering the meals and the dishes and the sort of the dining events that she had with her late consort, Gertrude Stein. So it's an elegy in the sense that she is trying to remember and celebrate and memorialize a lost mate, an individual, and even a lost way of life, because there was the life before the Second World War, and then there's the life after the Second World War. Of course, and Toklas and Stein both being Jews, you know, that's quite a difference, right? Even though they were hidden in plain sight very successfully in the French countryside. Lewis is different because the Sankofa is not saying this is in the past and will ever be. It's something that must be remembered so you can go forward. Right. When Toklas ends the Alice B. Toklas cookbook, it's on a dreary day and she's remembering the past and, you know, like you really have a sense of an ending, right? To use that phrase, that things are gone, that they're not going to come back. Lewis is writing her cookbook to bring things back, to let people know that there's this certain kind of cuisine and celebration of rural life, of community, and that people can recapture it.
Yeah, so your final chapter is about Arturo Schomburg's unfinished cookbook, something that only exists in the archive. So tell us a little bit about what that looks like. Where is it? What's in it? What is it like?
Oh, I've been fascinated with that for a long time. Doris Witt and David Lupton's appendix to Doris's Black Hunger book first alerted me to that. In fact, it's a helpful start for people who are interested in seeing what Black cookbooks have been out there, particularly before, say, 1950. And I thought, well, it's never been published. What is it? So I went to... at the time was not in New York. So I wrote the Schomburg and I asked them, you know, the old fashioned way before email, could I get a copy? How many pages is it? And long story short, I got a copy of the typescript. It's a number of pages of lists of recipes, for calves brains, for ice cream, for fried chicken, for, beef stew, as well as a few pages of basically it's part memoir because he recalls meals and dining events and just reflections on who was a chef, who should be remembered. He mentioned some names, but puzzlingly doesn't mention others. So though I can read it now, and you can read it now, go to the library and say, oh, this is fascinating. He's talking about early Black chefs, but he doesn't seem to know who Hercules is, who's George Washington's now famous chef, or James Hemings, who was a very, very well-known chef in his time also, and the brother, of course, to Jefferson's, I don't know, one always stumbles. What do we call Sally Hemings? A consort? A concubine? It's really not clear how very complicated that, we can imagine how complicated it is, and I'm sure it was even more complicated. But he was her older brother, and he was employed as a slave to Jefferson, and when they all went to France, when he was doing his diplomatic thing, he was trained in the best kitchens in Paris, became fluent in French. He spoke French and English, and came back to the United States with Jefferson. He said he wanted his freedom. Jefferson said he could have it, but on one condition, that he train another slave to take his place in the kitchen. So another Hemings sibling, a younger brother, was trained to take over, and James was manumitted. But he never cooked in the White House, and he actually died in his 30s, rather tragically, and it's not quite clear what happened to him, but he died. And finding out what exactly was the trajectory of a chef like Hercules, there's some really good stuff in Erica Dunbar Armstrong's Oney Judge book. How do we write the biography of people who did not leave texts behind? Hemings left maybe two or three sheets of paper, an inventory and a recipe. I think you can even see them on the Monticello website. Hercules, we don't have anything written. And you can think of that. I think it's Augustus Jackson, who worked in the Madison White House and is sometimes credited for inventing ice cream, though ice cream was invented before him. But he popularized a better way of making it and even had a confectionery store at one point. George Crumb, again, was said to be the Saratoga Springs chef who invented the potato chip. Potato chips were undoubtedly around before him, but he's the person who put them sort of on the American map, so to speak. So they were people who, if you know something about Black culinary history, are missing. So that made me think, how did Schomburg, who was this self-taught historian, and the collector wonderful collection of African-American historical texts, ephemera, various, say the Cuban independence, group archives and all kinds of things, statues, like Richmond Barthay statues, physical objects become the core of what is now the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture of the New York Public Library. How did he go about this? How could he go about this? And I think maybe one of the reasons he didn't finish it, because it was something that would take such digging. He didn't have the time to do it because he was busy running the library or because, you know, he ran out of time because he had many projects. He died of something that would be prevented with antibiotics today, I believe, an infection from dental work. But his research as such, I found intriguing. And I did this by finding out, like, who, and when he says Marcellus is ice cream, who is Marcellus? And Marcellus, I learned good. This is where the internet comes in handy. You start typing in strings of things, you will learn about matters. So Marcellus's ice cream is in the Bluegrass Cookbook, or William Dease's recipes are in 200 Years of Charleston cookbooks. So he was reverse engineering a history of Black culinary achievements by seeing and finding where African American cooks are cited and celebrated in white authored cookbooks, and then working backward from what he knows to try, you know, to at least sketch out what this kind of cookbook could be, but then was never finished. Oh yeah. And then he said, and you know, and he knows at the same time that these are, you know, often deeply racist depictions, right? We go back to that whole, you know, the genius, you know, the Black woman genius in the cook, you know, in the kitchen, right? In Uncle Tom's Cabin. And you actually, the earliest I think that I recall is in the beginning of the 19th century with James Fenimore Cooper's The Spy, where the Black person in the kitchen is a man named Caesar. But again, so he's trying to, how do we find this information? And it's not just because we can go to the library and say, okay, we're going to go to the either the card catalog or the, you know, the virtual catalog and type in Hercules, chef of George Washington, and it'll pop up, right? That doesn't happen. So we had to work really, really hard to try to figure out not just, I mean, this soul food was not, you know, that would be anachronistic. Not just what he would call the cuisine of the quarters, right? He said the flavory cuisine that African-Americans, you know, left to their own devices might like, but also the cuisine he knew, the fantastic, highly articulated cuisine that African-American chefs were creating for their white so-called owners or employers.
Yeah, so just as a way to wrap up our conversation, one thing that I appreciated about your book was that there's a lot of chapters, but they're so compact. They seem kind of perfectly packaged for assigning to undergrad students. So I teach a class on the literary cookbook, and I assign sometimes cookbooks in my more traditional literature classes. Is this material that you regularly get to teach, and how do you prepare students to read cookbooks when most of them really haven't had a lot of exposure to them, maybe?
Yeah, well, I give them, you know, secondary source readings, right? So, you know, hopefully some of my chapters, which I tried to make, actually, I was working on making it lead and mean, this book. So I'm tickled that it's been recognized as such. I don't necessarily teach a lot of cookbooks. Well, I teach food and American literature classes, so I might teach a cookbook like Verda Mae Smart Grosvenor's Vibration Cooking, because it's both a cookbook, very obviously a cookbook, and a memoir. I will include Coming of Age of Mississippi, because it is a memoir about the civil rights movement, which is so much about food and largely about what we now call food insecurity and food injustice. They can read, if in that course I used America largely, so we also read, you know, like Water for Chocolate by Laura Esquivel as well. So in a literature class, there are fewer cookbooks as such. I might use Sassafras, Cypress and Indigo by Entezaki Shange. And there are always new books like Monique Twong's book that's a reimagining, the Book of Salt, it's called, a reimagining of the stereotyped, quote-unquote, Chinese chef that Toklas refers to in her cookbook, right? He's actually Vietnamese, but she's constantly referring to him as Chinese, right? This sort of flattening, like this sort of Asian. And Monique, how Monique Truong takes back that sort of brief stereotype, and she embodies that character with a rich interior and exterior life. It's a lovely book. In my most recent book on African-American foodways, we looked at community cookbooks. We looked at, I had them look at the National Council of Negro Women's historical cookbook from 1958 and see different ways that people can compile a cookbook, because that's very much a history that's sort of bedecked with recipes, right? And it goes not by breakfast, lunch, dinner, desserts, drinks, but by the month. So that January, of course, will start out with Hoppin' John, but other months might celebrate somebody's birthday, right? February, you could have something to say about Frederick Douglass, because February 14th is the day he celebrated his birthday. But we also then begin that class with readings from folks like Judith Carney, who's and Nicholas Rosmoff, there in The Shadow of Slavery, which is their study of African-American diasporic foodways coming from the continent to the United States and the Caribbean and Latin America.
That sounds fascinating. So we've been talking today with Rafia Zafar about her new book, Recipes for Respect, African-American Meals and Meaning from the University of Georgia Press. Thank you, Rafia, for talking with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I was delighted to be invited to talk about one of my favorite subjects.